gave his assent. "We'll stay and fight together." He raised his double-bladed axe.
"We're dwarves,"
thundered Ironheart, who had finally found his voice. Tucking in his head, he squared his shoulders and took a deep breath.
"We never give in,"
he bellowed at the beasts, beating his axes together until the smelting works echoed with the noise.
"Do you hear that, you worthless scoundrels? It's the sound of your deaths!"
Tungdil offered a silent prayer to Vrakas.
"There's nothing for it but to fight our way through."
He looked into the faces of his companions.
"There's a good chance that not all of us will make it. What matters is that the right ones survive."
He glanced at Belindis.
"I'm expendable. I'll gladly give my life if it means Gurdlagard and its peoples have a future."
Fergus's eyes filled with tears as he kissed Narmora passionately. She was among those who had to survive at all costs. She stroked his cheek tenderly.
1 to 100,
was Boindil's assessment of their respective numbers.
"It could be worse."
This time, he blew the bugle, sounding the ancient dwarven call to war. It was answered by hostile shouts. Boindil glanced at his companions.
"Race you to the other side."
After 500 paces, they had fought themselves into an impasse, unable to advance or retreat. Surrounded on all sides by the foulest of creatures, the company stood shoulder to shoulder and faced the prospect of fighting until their arms were too heavy to deflect the deadly blows. Worse still, they had lost Rodario in the first 10 paces. He had been swallowed among the mass of orcish bodies, and by the time Tungdil noticed his absence, the impresario was nowhere to be seen. With Rodario, they lost the dragonfire with which the furnace was to be lit.
"We're so close now, Vrakas."
"We need to go back,"
he shouted over his shoulder.
"We've lost Rodario and the only torch."
Andrakai was about to reply when roaring flames shot toward the ceiling.
"Get back!"
A voice rasped imperiously from the door.
"Let me deal with them."
The noise stopped instantly. In a flash, a path opened through the rabble, the beasts drawing away to let their master pass. A corpulent figure in malachite robes strode toward them, extinguishing the last spark of hope that Tungdil had been kindling with dwarven obstinacy.
"Nodorn."
An awed whisper swept through the ranks of beasts, who were staring at the Magus in fascination, some bowing or falling to their knees.
"I thought I would find the villains here,"
he rasped, his voice giving way to a cough. A bright red globule of saliva spattered onto the face of a Bognil, whose tongue shot out hungrily and licked it away.
"I sent my servants here to ambush you. I wanted to have the pleasure of destroying you myself."
An orc leapt forward, whipping out his sword.
"Let me do it for you, master,"
he said slavishly.
"Silence, ingrate!"
The Magus stretched a hand. There was a flash of light, and flame shot out of his fingers, setting the orc ablaze. The beast staggered backward, stumbling in agony, until at last he lay still.
"Out of my way!"
commanded Nerdorn.
"If you crowd me, I can't destroy them without destroying you!"
His pale face was almost entirely obscured by a cowl, with only a chink of white skin visible through the folds of cloth.
"I'll do what I can,"
Andrakai whispered to Tungdil.
"The rest of you run."
She pushed her fair hair back from her severe visage, seized her sword, and prepared to strike. All of a sudden, she stopped. Tungdil sensed her hesitation.
"What's wrong?"
She seemed puzzled.
"I can't see his staff. Nodon would never be parted with it, no more than I would go anywhere without my sword. It must be an illusion."
"Ye gods, it's Rodario!"
hissed Fergus, trying not to blow his friend's cover by looking too relieved. Tungdil stared in disbelief. The impresario's transformation was as complete as it had been on the stage, but now he was playing to an audience who would kill him and eat him if his performance was anything less than faultless.
"How does he do it?"
"As for you,"
the sham Magus rasped at the company,
"you shall suffer. But first I shall be merciful. You may advance to the forge and touch the hallowed door. Only then will my servants rip you to pieces. Is that not exquisitely cruel?
The beasts cheered excitedly. This time the crowd parted on the other side of the company, allowing them to proceed through a narrow corridor toward the locked door. The sham magus followed behind them, swaying, coughing, and whipping his followers into a frenzy as he threatened the company with increasingly diabolical fates. They were 10 paces from the door when the impresario swayed more vigorously than usual and stumbled.
Stop!
Tungdil grabbed Nomura and Fergus before they could rush to his aid.
You'll give the game away for all of us!
The costumed Rodario struggled upright. A helmet rolled out from beneath his robes, and his left leg seemed suddenly a good deal shorter. Without the makeshift stilt that had allowed him to tower majestically at the real Magus's height, the fakery was obvious. It took the beasts a few moments to fathom the situation.
That's not Nadon!
An orc rushed toward him, brandishing his sword, as the company closed ranks around the hobbling Rodario, and the battle recommenced.
What have you done with the torch?
Demanded Tungdil. Clutching his side, the impresario coughed up another mouthful of blood. This time he was wounded, and not just relying on his props. Even so, he managed a smile as he held up a small lantern. The wick was burning brightly.
No self-respecting magus would dream of carrying a torch.
Their courage restored, they fought their way more determinedly than ever toward the door, while the orcs pushed aside their smaller colleagues and attacked with full force. They were determined to put an end to the indefatigable men and dwarves. Every member of the company was struck by an axe, sword, or mace. Some of the wounds were more serious than others, but the dwarves stood their ground. Tungdil focused on deciphering the runic password that would gain them entry to the forge. For once, his knowledge failed him.
I can't read the runes!
He cried despairingly to Andukai.
It must be a riddle! How awfully inconvenient, gasped Rodario.
He clutched the door, trying to hold himself up as his legs gave way.
I don't expect my death to trouble you greatly, but remember this, Gerdligard has lost a luminary of the stage.
He closed his eyes and slumped to the ground, suffocating the lantern as he fell. The flame flickered dangerously.
No!
Murmured Gandagar, who had been watching the dying actor out of the corner of his eye.
We can't let the flame go out!
As he turned to save the lantern, an enormous orc seized his chance and waded in. With a terrible shout, he thrust his notched sword toward the king's back.
Your Majesty!
Goimgar realized mid-shout that the warning would come too late. Without thinking, he threw himself, shield first and head ducked, into the path of the blade. With a high-pitched ring, the sword struck the edge of the shield, forcing it down. The dwarf's head and neck appeared above the rim. The orc bared its teeth, expelling a foul rush of breath, which swept through Goimgar's beard. The beast's long blade settled on the shield, using its contours to draw a perfect line from right to left. Goimgar thrust his blade forward, but it was no match for the orcish sword. His stumpy weapon shattered, shards of metal jangling to the floor, and the sword continued, cleaving through skin, flesh, sinew, and bone. As the artisan's head fell to the right, his twitching body toppled left, brushing against Belindis, who let out a furious howl and swung her axe with fresh savagery. Gandagar turned in time to see Goimgar die in his stead. Even as the head hit the floor, the flame died, a thin wisp of smoke snaking its way to the ceiling.
May Tion take you!
Gandagar raised his axe and split the murderer from skull to chest. With two of their number dead and the dragonfire extinguished, the company struggled against the heaviness in their arms. Their resistance was weakening.
Did you get us this far in order to destroy us, Vrakis?
Tungdil shouted accusingly as he drove his axe between the jaws of an orc. At that moment, there was a welcome grinding noise, and the right-hand panel of the door swung open. The deep tones of a bugle rang out, echoing the melody that Boindil had sounded at the beginning of their attack. Stocky figures streamed through the doors and threw themselves on the beasts. Their axes and hammers raged mercilessly among the hordes. It took Tungdil a good few moments to realize that their rescuers were dwarves. One of their number, a warrior whose polished armor outshone everything save the diamonds on his belt, nodded toward the open door.
"Hurry! We can't hold them back for long!"
he bellowed, his deep voice sending shivers down Tungdil's spine. He was more used to seeing the warrior's features cast in Vrakassium and gold, but he had encountered the visage often enough during their long march through the Fifthling Kingdom to know exactly who he was. Giselbert Ironeye, father of Giselbert's folk.
"I thought you were..."
"We'll talk later,"
the ancient dwarf told him.
"Just get your company inside."
Tungdil gave the order. Fergus hoisted Rodario to his shoulders, and Gandagar carried Goimgar's corpse. As soon as the group was safely in the forge, Giselbert's dwarves abandoned their attack and slammed the door behind them. A moment later, there was a furious hammering and pounding, but blind rage alone was not enough to breach the door.
"Welcome," Giselbert said solemnly. "Whoever you may be, I hope your coming is a good omen."
There were 10 of them in all, ashen-faced dwarves with absent eyes that made them seem vaguely trance-like. Each was clad in lavishly splendid mail, and their beards reached to their belts. Determination, a Vrakas-given trait of their race, was stamped on every face.
"My warriors and I have been fighting Teon's minions since the fall of my kingdom 1100 cycles ago,"
said Giselbert, who seemed the most venerable, the most majestic of them all.
"We are the last of the Fifthlings, killed by the Alfar and resurrected by the perished land. As you can see, we chose not to serve it."
Tungdil shot a quick glance at Bavrigor, who was covered from head to toe in every imaginable shade of green. Orc and Bognil blood was dripping from his hands and splashing to the floor.
"It takes a lot to kill an undead dwarf, but most of our companions were eventually slain. The rest of us retreated to the furnace, our folk's most treasured relic."
He held Tungdil's gaze. "And you're sure you don't hate other dwarves and want to murder every living creature?" Giselbert shook his head.
"We taught ourselves not to. In 1100 cycles you can learn to stifle the pestilent hatred."
His eyes shifted to the door.
"The creatures used to content themselves with guarding the entrance. But during the last few orbits, they've laid siege to the doors. I dare say the change has something to do with you."
"Very likely."
Tungdil ran through the introductions and gave a hasty account of the threat facing Girdlegard and the reason for their coming.
"But it's all been in vain. We were supposed to light the furnace with dragonfire, but the flame went out while we were fighting by the door."
Giselbert clapped a hand on his shoulder, and a kindly smile spread across the creases and wrinkles of his ancient face.
"You are wrong to give up hope. The fire is burning as fiercely as ever."
He stopped and listened.
"The furnace has always been under our protection. Vrakas must have known we would need it one day."
He and his companions stepped aside to reveal the rest of the chamber. The hall, 50 paces long by 30 wide, boasted 20 abandoned hearths, lined up in 2 rows, and 4 times as many anvils, arranged around an enormous furnace, ablaze with fierce white flames. Countless pillars supported the ceiling, 80 paces above, and the walls were filled with neat rows of tools. Hammers, tongs, chisels, files, and all manner of implements needed for the blacksmith's craft. Fine sand covered the floor, and the upper reaches of the chamber were coated in a thick layer of soot. A stone stairway led to the flue. The bellows and grindstones were attached to metal chains that ran through a system of rollers and pulleys to the ceiling, where they looped through the rock. Tungdil was instantly reminded of the lifting apparatus in the underground network. He found himself imagining the smithy in its heyday, when Girdlegard's finest weapons and most splendid armor had been forged by Giselbert's dwarves. He breathed out in relief and prayed to Vrakas to excuse his lack of faith.
"That's the best news we've had since Ogre's death," he said cheerfully. "We're nearly there,
and to think I'd resigned myself to failure.
"He's alive!" exclaimed Fergus. "His heart is beating! Rodario's alive!"
"Let me take a look at him." Andukai swept back her hair, knelt beside the wounded impresario, and inspected his wound. "He's had a blow to the head and a slight gouge to the side. It's nothing too serious," she announced, cleaning the afflicted area with Bavragor's brandy to stave off infection. The impresario's eyes fluttered open.
"Thank you, estimable Mega," he gasped,
gritting his teeth as the alcohol stung his raw flesh.
"Had I known, I would have begged the orc to strike me on the mouth so you could kiss me back to life."
"If you were a warrior, things might have been different between us," she said, responding remarkably favorably to the flirtation.
"A good actor can be many things, even a warrior.
But it's only an act."
"I'm a warrior in spirit. Isn't that enough?"
"Maybe," she said. "But your weapon has fought for so many causes in every kingdom that I couldn't rely on you not to swap sides." Her blue eyes looked at him smilingly as she patted his cheek.
"Save your charm for the women who adore you."
Giselbert pointed to a quiet corner of the smithy.
"Lie down and get some rest. The doors won't fall. We'll see to it that they don't. It's important that you recover your strength before we get going with Keenfire. There are some matters we need to attend to before we can forge the blade."
"Such as?"
The ancient monarch chuckled when he saw the look of alarm on Tungdil's face.
"It can wait until you're rested. I'm sorry we can't offer you any sustenance, but you'll be safe here at least."
The travelers were too tired to do anything but follow his advice. Even Boindil was so spent that he forgot to be suspicious of their undead hosts. In any case, no one could claim that the Revenants weren't putting their lives to good use. Tungdil went to join Gandagar, who was sitting in silence beside Goimgar's corpse. The Fourthling King had removed his battered helmet, his brown hair resting on his mighty shoulders.
"He died trying to save me,"
he said somberly.
"He threw himself in front of that orc, even though he must have known the brute would kill him."
He glanced at Tungdil.
"I didn't think he had it in him. I was pleased when you picked Goimgar because he seemed too much the artisan and too little the dwarf. I misjudged him. He was a dwarf, all right."
Tungdil placed the pouch of diamonds in Gandagar's hands.
"You're our diamond cutter now. You must finish his task for him."
"Gladly, although I can't promise to emulate his skill. Goimgar was a far better artisan than I am."
Tungdil paused before broaching a rather delicate subject.
"There's something I need to tell you, Gandagar."
He quickly told him of Gundrabur's plan and Bislipur's trickery, and finished by producing Sverd's collar as proof. The king recognized the choker at once.
"By the beard of Goimdil, I wish these accusations were unfounded, but the loathsome collar speaks for itself. Sverd was enthralled to his master. He could never have acted alone."
He shook his head incredulously.
"How could Bislipur be so blind? How could I be so blind?"
"So you don't want to wage war on the elves?"
"Absolutely not. Isn't Gerdlegard in enough trouble already?"
He took a deep breath.
"Honestly, Tungdil, nothing could be farther from my thoughts. Gundrabur was right after all. We've been through so much since the start of this mission that the thought of another war... No, an alliance is what we need."
He stopped and frowned.
"I'm not saying we have to be best friends with the elves or anything. The way they betrayed the Fifthlings was..." "We weren't betrayed by elves,"
interrupted a Fifthling who had approached in time to hear the end of their exchange. His thick black beard hung in decorative cords that reached to his chest.
"Your folk was betrayed by the pointy ears," the king insisted. "I saw the evidence myself."
"Evidence provided by Bislipur," Tungdil reminded him.
The stranger gave them a wan smile.
"My name is Glandalin Hammerstrike, of the clan of the Striking Hammers."
He turned to Gandagar.
"I witnessed the terrible demise of our kingdom, and I saw the traitor who opened our gates." "Yes," Gandagar said stubbornly, "a backstabbing elf." "It was a dwarf,"
He paused as the others, including Belindis, who had joined them, stared in disbelief.
Glamdulin Strongarm was the traitor who spoke the incantation and opened our gates. But why? It was the opportunity he had been waiting for. That dreadful morning, he pretended to succumb to the fever that the Alpha had spread among our folk. The battle was fierce, and no one gave him a second thought. He skulked down to the gates and cleared the way for Teon's hordes. It was his doing that the Alpha found their way into our underground halls and took us by surprise. But I don't see. He was a thirdling,
Glendalen said flatly.
A child of Lorimbur, a dwarf killer, who inveigled himself into our folk and masked his true intentions so cunningly that we suspected nothing. He waited until we were fatally weakened, then struck the final blow. He died by my axe, but was raised by the perished land to incant the secret runes. After our deaths, we captured him and questioned him. Glamdulin was beheaded, never to rise again.
I hope you're writing this down for me, Rodario whispered to Fergus. We'll make our fortunes with this play.
So the elves had nothing to do with it,
said Tungdil, delighted that the path was clear for an alliance.
Bislipur's treacherous scheme has come to naught.
They buried Goimgar's body in a corner of the forge, erected a pile of stones to mark the grave, and dedicated his soul to Vrakas. As soon as they felt sufficiently rested, they began their preparations for forging the mighty axe. The blade must be made of the purest, hardest steel, with diamonds encrusting the bit, and an alloy of every known precious metal filling the inlay and the runes. The spurs should be hewn from stone, and the grip sculpted from wood of the Sigurdaisy tree, recited Tungdil, reading from the manuscript that would serve as their guide. They stacked the gold, silver, palladium, and vrakasium neatly on the table, along with the pouch of diamonds and the Sigurdaisy wood for the haft. The fifthlings furnished them with iron ore for the blade and stone for the spurs. Tungdil realized with alarm what it was they were missing.
We didn't bring any Teonium,
he said, scolding himself for his laxness.
You don't have any, I suppose?
There was a short silence.
Not in the forge, said Glendalen. We were never especially fond of Teon's metal, so there wasn't much call for it.
Narmora unhooked an amulet from her neck and laid it on the table.
It's pure Teonium. My mother gave it to me to ward off the forces of good. Since I've allied myself with them, there's not much point in wearing it. I just hope there's enough for you to use.
Tungdil gave her a grateful look. His doubts and reservations about the half-elf had been cancelled out by her deeds.
Girdlegard is in your debt twice over. No matter how expertly we fashion the weapon, Keenfire would be powerless without Teonium, or without the undergroundling's foe. It's the least I can do, given the amount of suffering my mother's race has caused, she demurred.
He glanced at the glowing furnace.
Shall we begin?
I'm afraid it's not that simple, said Giselbert. The furnace is alight, but the temperature isn't high enough. Usually we'd use the bellows to breathe life into Dragonfire, but the equipment has rusted and we haven't been able to get it to work.
Thank goodness for that!
Fergus leapt to his feet.
What with Narmora being the savior of Girdlegard, I was beginning to think I was just a hanger-on.
He chuckled good-humouredly, and the others joined in.
I hope you're ready for a demonstration of my expertise.
He was rewarded with a kiss from Narmora, who picked up her axe to practice wards, attacks, and strikes with Boindil. Andukai sat watching them, while Jerun, motionless as usual, crouched beside her. For some reason, Tungdil was half expecting the helmet to give off a purple glow.
You're wondering what's behind the visor, aren't you? Said Narmora,
recovering her breath. She pressed the canteen of water thirstily to her lips. He turned to her.
Is there something I should know?
Narmora leaned against the wall of polished rock, still panting with exertion. Boindil was a hard taskmaster, and the combat sessions left her exhausted.
When I was little, my mother told me stories about a terrifying being, the king among Teon's and Samusin's creatures, the predator of predators, the hunter who hunted his own kind,
destroying the weak and fighting the strong to make them stronger, or to kill them if their ascendancy was undeserved. Namora dabbed the sweat from her brow. She said that his eyes shone with violet light, and that weaker beings fled for their lives at the sight of him. All the beasts are terrified of Samusin's son. She used to scare the living daylights out of me with those stories. She grinned, then averted her gaze, careful not to glance in the giant's direction. And back then I didn't know that they were true. The explanation didn't take Tungdil entirely by surprise. Samusin was Andakai's chosen deity, and she would doubtless feel honored to be traveling with a creature who was said to be his son. Whether or not Jerun was more than just a servant to the Magar was a question that Tungdil was reluctant to ponder. No wonder the Bognilim bolted. Most creatures would run away from him, beasts of Tion or not. Namora got up to resume her drills. He watched as Belindis kindled one of the hearths with ordinary flames. After stripping off her mail and leather jerkin, she donned a leather apron that covered her chest and her midriff, although her undergarments left a good deal of flesh on show. He made his way over to see what she was doing.
"What are you up to?"
"Making steel," she said,
signaling for him to tie her apron at the back. Standing behind her, he caught his first proper glimpse of female skin. It was pink and covered in wispy down. There hadn't been much opportunity for washing of late, so she had a strong smell about her, but it wasn't unpleasant. Not clean exactly, but still quite arousing.
"The blast furnaces are on the other side of the door, so I'm having to smelt the metal by other means. It's a trick of the trade."
Belindis's apron strings were safely knotted, but Tungdil found himself clasping her sturdy hips. Her skin felt smooth and warm. He stroked the fine hairs.
"Come here so you can see what I'm doing."
He did as he was told.
"First we have to get rid of the impurities, which is why I'm placing the ore in a shallow pan. The heat will burn them off. Unfortunately, it means we can produce only small quantities of steel at a time, but it should be enough for a blade."
She stood there, waiting patiently for the temperature to rise and the iron to melt.
"Surely you've done this before."
"No,"
he said regretfully. "I was only a blacksmith." "How many strikes for a horseshoe nail?"
7 if I concentrate, 9 if I don't."
"Not bad,"
she said with a smile that made his cheeks flush redder than the molten ore.
"It takes me 7 strikes too."
"How many for an axe?"
7 if I concentrate, 9 if I don't.
Orbits, that is, not strikes. Since time is of the essence right now, I'll work straight through, and it should be done in 5 orbits, without the quality suffering at all."
She drew his attention to Giselbert, who was waving at them from the doors.
"I think he wants to show you something."
Tungdil raised his hand to indicate that he was coming.
It's hard to believe that he and the others are older than anything we've ever encountered, save the mountains themselves. And to think that they're revenants as well. It's so sad that their souls were stolen by the perished land. I wish there was something we could do to get them back.
Only Vrakas can restore their souls. But you're right, it must be awful for them.
He hurried over to the anxious Giselbert.
"The beasts are preparing to attack."
Tungdil studied the heavy metal doors. They were reinforced with steel bindings and protected with Vrakas's runes.
"I thought you said the forge was safe."
"It was, until you gave them a reason to breach the doors. They know you're here, and they know you're forging a weapon that will bring about their doom. Their priorities have changed."
He pointed to a peephole, and Tungdil peered through. In the course of a single orbit, the ragged hordes had become an orderly army under the Alfar's command. A short distance from the doors was a growing pile of pillars and stalactites, torn down and stacked by a unit of ogres. Beyond that, further divisions of beasts were putting the finishing touches on what looked like hoists.
"You're right. It looks serious. I'll have to warn the others. What do we have in the way of defenses?"
Giselbert raised his axe.
"Is that all?"
The fifthling raised another axe and gave a wry smile.
"It's not enough. I know. We..."
He was interrupted by muffled shrieks and jangling armor. Ogres bellowed, orcs snarled anxiously, Bognilim yelped in terror.
"What's going on out there?" Tungdil pressed his face to the peephole just as the fires went out in the encampment. Dwarf-sized warriors with pale faces poured out of the darkness, swarming among the beasts and cleaving through their ranks. They seemed to be deliberately beheading their opponents so that none could be raised from the dead. The attack was over in moments. The flames were rekindled and the invaders disappeared without a trace.
The spirits of the dead dwarves!
He thought back to the pale figures and their mysterious warning. Teon's hordes had colonized their realm against their wishes, and the vengeful ghosts had made them pay. What do you know about dwarven ghosts?
Ghosts? Nothing. But I'm glad they've decided to help.
Tungdil hurried to tell the others of the imminent attack. Everyone not involved in forging Keenfire was put to work hewing boulders to barricade the doors. All that mattered for the moment was keeping the beasts at bay. Later, they would have to figure out a way of getting themselves and the weapon out of the forge. The company's faith in Fergus proved well-founded. It took him less than an orbit to get to grips with the bellows. According to him, the pulley system worked in much the same way as a stage curtain, a parallel that he found especially apt. Having located the damage, he repaired it, improvising a solution with the presence of mind and ingenuity befitting a prop master who had rescued plenty of performances from mechanical disaster. He even got the grindstone turning again. Meanwhile, the others continued their efforts to barricade the doors. The beasts had already launched an initial offensive, which failed because the stalactites shattered against the doors. When the second orbit dawned, Gandagar began work on the diamonds. The environment could scarcely have been less conducive to his task, but he was fortunate to have use of Goimgar's tools. Bavrigor sat at a table and fashioned the spurs, his hands moving with the mechanical jerkiness of a puppet on strings. Giselbert prepared the casts for the precious metals, while Belindis threw herself into forging the blade and its shaft, which itself was the length of a forearm. She set up her workshop in the middle of the chamber near Dragonfire. With every sigh of the machine-driven bellows, the coals hissed and crackled, sometimes spitting white flames. Her work was spread between three anvils of different sizes and shapes. Time after time, she reached confidently for the appropriate tool among the rows of rivet tongs, wolf-jaw tongs, duck-bill tongs, and six dozen or so similar implements, extracted the red-hot steel from the fire, hammered it approximately into shape, and replaced it in its fiery bed of coals as soon as the metal cooled. Tungdil had never seen such a magnificent forge. Whereas he was accustomed to four types of hammer, there was a choice of 50, and all with different heads, not to mention the chisels, files, saws, and other tools that Belindis employed with obvious skill. "I could use your help," she said suddenly, handing him some tongs. "Draw out the steel to the thickness of a knife blade. Halve the metal with your axe, and lay the sections on top of each other." Tungdil did as instructed, reaching into the furnace with his long-handled tongs. White flames licked the coals, emitting a phenomenal warmth. The steel was white-hot when he placed it on the anvil. He drew it out quickly and returned it to the flames, waiting for it to glow, before transferring it to the anvil, dividing it in half, and hammering the two sections vigorously into a single strip. It had been so long since he had last stood at the anvil that he felt a rush of elation as he brought down the hammer and tapped out a rhythm. This was the wizardry of the dwarves, their ability to induce metal to perform wondrous miracles that a Magus or Formulus would never understand. He glanced at Belindis happily. Without realizing, they were hammering in unison. At length, he laid down his tools.
"I ought to go back to shifting boulders before the others start accusing me of ruining the blade. How many layers will it have when it's finished?"
"About 300, she replied, still hammering. "It's good steel, so it can take it. Thanks for the help."
Tungdil gave her a wave and joined the working party at the doors. The fifthlings hurried back and forth tirelessly, their undead bodies able to function without rest, but Tungdil and Boindil were only too aware of the importance of conserving their strength. Most of their provisions had been eaten already, and the rest would have to be rationed until they left the forge.
"Vragus must be really far-sighted," said Boindil after a time. "To think that he brought us all together like this."
"What do you mean?"
asked Tungdil, surprised to hear the warrior pondering such matters. Bowindil, his skin bronzed from orbits in the sun, turned his bearded face toward him.
Each one of us has a vital role to play. We needed you to come up with the plan in the first place, Belindis and the others to make the blade, the impresario to save us from the runts, Fergus to repair the bellows, and the pointy-eared actress to strike the Magus down.
He sat down on a rock.
There couldn't be a better team.
What about Goimgar?
Well, we needed Goimgar to save Gandagar.
Aren't you forgetting the warrior twins? You and your brother wiped out anyone who stood in our way, and kept fighting when others would have lost their nerve. We wouldn't have got this far if it weren't for you. He gave him a hearty thump on the back. Bowindil grinned.
More incredibly, we turned our scholar into a proper, respectable dwarf. Living with the longings sent your instincts to sleep. But we've woken them up for you, Tungdil.
He made to strike him with his axe.
Truth be told, you're pretty handy with a weapon. You must have been born a warrior.
Born a warrior?
Tungdil was painfully reminded that he still knew nothing of his birth. For once, Bowindil picked up on his mood.
Cheer up, Tungdil. If the Forthlings won't have you, you can always live with us,
he promised breezily.
I'll swear by the beard of Berwyn that you're the illegitimate cousin of my estranged aunt, 34 times removed.
They both laughed. Giselbert, who had been peering through the peephole at regular intervals, headed over from the door. His expression was grave.
They've fashioned new battering rams. This time they might actually work.
Is there any other way out? Asked Tungdil. Rodario's act won't fool them again.
He looked up at the chimney towering above the furnace.
Would that do the trick?
Our scholar is full of inspiration,
Bowindil said admiringly.
It might, but the stairs are pretty steep.
We'll manage,
Tungdil assured him.
Nothing can stop us from saving Girdlegard, especially not now that the axe is almost finished.
Just then, an almighty crash shook the walls, as if the mountain were collapsing around them. The doors shuddered, fragments of rock rained all around them, and the metal panels strained and groaned. The attack had begun in earnest. Chapter 8 Giselbert's Folk, Fifthling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Winter, 6,234th Solar Cycle. For three whole orbits, the forge echoed with continual pounding and thudding against the doors, and the beast's persistence began to pay off. The solid iron panels were already bulging in the middle, and the metal showed signs of cracking under the force of the brutal assault. Tungdil had requisitioned one of the anvils and was frantically forging bars to add to the barricade, but it was obvious that the beasts would eventually force their way in. Belindis had almost finished the blade and was about to begin the fine-tuning. The task of engraving the metal was entrusted to Giselbert, who marked the warm steel with runes and patterns for the inlay. Gandagar had cut the diamonds to size and left them on his makeshift workbench. Each gem had been sharpened to a deadly point that would slit the Magus open. The spurs, carved by Bavrigor from black granite, were as long as a human index finger, and were waiting to be attached. Tungdil, under directions from Narmora, sculpted the grip using a hacksaw, a file, and a grindstone to shape the metal-like sigurdaisy wood to fit her hand. He left the sanding to her and went back to reinforcing the doors. On the fourth orbit, the heated blade was edged with diamonds, and the spurs were put in place. Belindis worked with utmost concentration. The metal was unforgiving, and every strike of the hammer was vital. The slightest mistake could cost her the blade, and there wasn't enough time to reforge it. The constant gong-like pounding on the doors was a distraction that they could all have done without. Giselbert was almost ready to combine the precious metals and create a single alloy, a process made possible by the incredible heat of the dragonfire. The others looked on in fascination as he heated the metals in individual pans. Rich gold, shimmering silver, orange vracassium, white palladium, and a coin-sized lump of black tionium. One by one, he emptied the molten contents into a bell-shaped vessel lined with glass. When it came to pouring the tionium, The black liquid hissed with Teon-like malice, angry at being united with an element as pure as Palladium. Another loud boom shook the hall, followed immediately by a cracking and snapping of metal. A battering ram smashed into the reinforced door, opening a gap half a pace across. In no time, a Bognil had squeezed through and was staring wide-eyed at his surroundings. He squealed in excitement.
"Come here, you ugly piglet!"
bellowed Ironheart, whooping exuberantly as he charged. At last he could allow his fury to run riot.
"So you think you're brave, do you? Let's see if my axes change your mind."
"Namora, you stay here," ordered Tungdil. "Everyone else, after him!"
Belindis, Giselbert, Andokai, and Jerun rushed to help Boindil, who shouted at them to go away. The pounding on the doors became faster and more violent. With victory in sight, the beasts redoubled their efforts. At last, the opening was wide enough for an orc to storm through. Arrows ripped through the gap, but inflicted no damage, save the occasional scratch. Tungdil knew that the breach could not be allowed to open further if he and the others were to stem the attack.
"We'll drive them back with dragonfire."
He ran to the furnace, heaped on some coals, and pumped the bellows until the fire roared with bright white flames. Hurriedly, he shoveled a few loads onto a wheeled anvil and rolled it to the doors. Without wasting a second, he filled his spade and hurled its contents over the heads and shoulders of the invaders. Red-hot coals showered over the beasts, covering them in sparks and coal dust that singed their faces, danced down their collars, and penetrated their chainmail. Loud screams rent the air, increasing in volume when the second fiery hail descended. There was an overwhelming stench of charred flesh, smoldering hair, and scorched leather. The orcs raised their shields above their heads in panic, allowing Tungdil and his companions to plunge their axes and hammers into their unprotected chests. Fergus kept them supplied with hot coals until the enemy retreated. The orcs went back to bombarding the forge with arrows.
"Sooner or later they're going to force their way in," predicted Andokai. "They'll form a shield wall, and we won't be able to stop them. It's time we left."
They made a concerted effort to close the doors, but the beasts had been cunning enough to jam them open with wedges.
"She's right. We need to get out of here as soon as we can."
Tungdil returned to the furnace.
"How much longer until the inlay is ready?" he asked Giselbert.
"The Teonium and the Palladium need to simmer for half an orbit. Once they've melded, the others will follow. After that, I'll be able to pour the alloy into the grooves. But then there's the cooling time. Will the doors hold?"
"They'll have to," growled Tungdil, nodding resolutely. "We'll see to it that they do."
From then on, Nodon's servants gave them no respite. The assault on the doors was unrelenting, and the beasts proceeded as the Maegar had predicted. Shields raised above their heads, they advanced in formation, protected from the glowing coals. Two of the fifthlings were beheaded, never to rise again. Their loss was a serious blow to the defenders, and already the next battering ram was pounding against the doors. The destructive will of the perished land was bent on assailing the forge.
"It is time!"
The long and wearying wait ended as Giselbert lifted the vessel containing the mountain's precious metals and poured them into the indented runes and symbols. The alloy's color was strangely indeterminate, somewhere between orange and yellow, with a peculiar shimmer and swirling black pinpoints. It streamed through the grooves with the assurance of a river that was familiar with its course, filling the channels without a drop to spare.
"Done!"
announced Giselbert, heaving a sigh of relief.
"In another half an orbit, when the inlay has cooled, we can set the blade on the haft and..."
A battering ram exploded through the ravaged metal doors. The protruding end of the pillar withdrew quickly, only to reappear just above the existing hole. The beasts had decided to fashion their own entrance. Tungdil took a deep breath. His arms were about to drop off. He had never felt hungrier in his life, and he was tired enough to sleep for an orbit. Instead, he raised his axe.
"We need to keep them at bay until the inlay has cooled!"
He paid no attention to the pain in his back and shoulders, determined not to flag. He was leader of the company, after all, and Gandagar deferred to him without a murmur, never questioning his authority. His selfless cooperation made Tungdil respect him all the more. Already the invaders were squeezing through the breach. In a flash, Iheart had thrown himself on the beasts, his enthusiasm for combat apparently undiminished. He hacked at the orcs so savagely that his axes were barely visible amid the scraps of flying armor and bloodied flesh. But even Ironheart's fury could do nothing to stem the attack. As time wore on, the battle swung steadily in favor of the beasts. With a third of the doorway smashed open, it was only thanks to Jerun and the indomitable fifthlings that the company hadn't been defeated already. Time was against them. Giselbert fought his way to Tungdil's side.
"You should go. The alloy has cooled enough for you to take Keenfire."
He raised his axe.
"We'll hold the beasts back until you're safely inside the flue. Then we'll shut the vents and destroy the mechanism. Without it, they won't be able to get into the chimney. You'll be miles away by the time they force their way inside."
Tungdil nodded gratefully and signaled for his company to retreat. The finished blade was lying on the central anvil, shimmering enigmatically in the bright light of dragonfire. The diamonds twinkled, the inlay glistened, and the runes shone with the fierce glow of the furnace, brought to life by the roaring flames. "To think that Vrakas gave us the means to accomplish this!" Tungdil gazed in awe at the result of their joint labor. "Belindis," he said solemnly, "attach the blade." She picked up the grip and inserted it into the long metal shaft of the blade. Her face paled.
"Vrakas forfend. It doesn't fit," she said hoarsely. "See how loose it is. The blade would fly off as soon as Namora swings the axe. But how could we have made the grip too narrow? I'm sure it."
One by one, the runes lit up. The shaft glowed, then the wood seemed to swell. Crackling and straining, it expanded to fill the gap, until the grip and the shaft were one. Tungdil took it as a sign that Vrakas was happy with their work. He ran his fingers over the blade, cherishing the feel of the metal. Deep down, he wished he could wield the axe himself, and he held onto it for a moment, before handing it to Namora. Giselbert stepped forward.
"May I?"
he asked tremulously.
"Of course. If it weren't for you and the others, it would never have been forged."
The ancient king grasped the axe, gazing at it reverently before trying a few swings. He entrusted it ceremoniously to the half-elf.
"So this is it,"
he said, his voice choked with emotion.
"The agony of the undead. All those cycles of waiting, of fighting. There was a reason for it all."
He shook hands with each of the company in turn, lingering when he came to Tungdil.
"Don't abandon my kingdom to the creatures of Teon. Free Gerdlegard, and drive out the pestilence. Then come back and rebuild my kingdom for the dwarves. Will you promise me that, Tungdil Goldhand?"
He fixed him with a piercing stare. Tungdil could do nothing but nod, rendered speechless by the zeal in the fifthling's eyes. Giselbert unfastened his diamond-studded weapons belt and laid it around Tungdil's waist.
"Wear this in memory of my folk, and let it be known that we defended our kingdom to the last, in death as well as life."
Tungdil swallowed.
"Your gift is too generous."
"From what I've come to know of you, it is no less than you deserve."
They embraced as friends. Then it was time for the company to leave.
"Let's get going,"
said Tungdil, looking up at the narrow staircase leading into the gloomy chimney. He glanced back at the doors, where the last of the fifthlings were locked in bitter combat with the orcs.
"But what will become of you?"
Bowindel asked the fifthling king. Giselbert stood tall, eyes fixed on the doors.
"My warriors will hold them back while you get yourselves out of here. We'll fight until they chop off our heads and put an end to our undead existence,"
he said proudly.
"Now go. The steps are shallower in the upper reaches of the chimney. Jerun will have to take care."
It was decided that Namora, as the nimblest among them, should lead the way and test the stairs. The humans and dwarves lined up behind her, with the giant at the rear. Bavrogor stayed by the furnace, a new warhammer in his hand.
"Aren't you coming with us?"
Tungdil asked cautiously. He shook his head.
I said from the beginning that I'd never go home. I set out to die a glorious death, and so I shall. This is what I wanted."
A profound calm had descended on him, allowing his mind, which had been battling against his undead state, to find peace. He turned his one eye toward Tungdil.
"Thank you for bringing me here, and for letting me be part of this."
"I gave you my word."
"You could have gone back on it. No one would have blamed you. They warned you about the Merry Minstrel, but you honored your promise."
He took a step forward and looked him in the eye.
"I shall die in the knowledge that my hands carved the most important bit of masonry in the history of the dwarves. No mason will trump it. Not unless Gerdlegard needs another keen fire, which I sincerely hope it never will."
"Is there anything I can say to persuade you?"
The mason chuckled, and something about his laughter reminded Tungdil of the cheerful ballad singer and joker of old.
"Persuade me? Tungdil, I'm a dwarf. I made my decision orbits ago."
He nodded toward the door.
"They need my help, and I shall fight alongside them. There could be no greater honor than to die side by side with the founding dwarves of the Fifthling Kingdom, the most ancient and venerable of our kin."
His calloused fingers gripped Tungdil's hand.
"You're a good dwarf, and that's what matters, not your lineage. Be sure to remember me, and old Shimmerbeard as well."
They embraced, and Tungdil let the tears course down his cheeks. Another friend was being taken from him, and he wasn't afraid to show his grief.
"As if I could ever forget you, Bavrogor Hammerfist. I shall remember you always."
He turned to look at Goimgar's grave.
"I'll never forget either of you."
Smiling, Bavrogor hurried to join the Fifthlings in the battle against the Hordes. After a couple of paces, he stopped and looked across at Boindil.
"Tell him that I forgive him for what he did," he said softly.
Tungdil stared at him in amazement.
"I can't tell him that," he protested. "He'd think I was making it up to make him feel better about himself."
"Then tell him I knew he loved my sister as much as I did, but I couldn't stand losing her. I was filled with hatred, and I couldn't hate death for taking her, so I hated the one who swung the blade. Hatred helped to silence the pain and the sorrow, and it was easier to live that way. Deep down I knew he loved her, and he never meant to kill her."
He chuckled gently.
"Death has made me wiser, Tungdil. May Vrakas protect Boindil and the others, but especially you."
He turned, and belting out a rousing melody, hurled himself into the unequal battle. His hammer smashed into an orcish knee, then crushed a beast's skull, and still he kept singing. Tungdil swallowed and hurried after his companions, who were rushing up the steps. Namora had already reached the entrance to the flue. As they ascended, Bavrogor's voice accompanied them through the darkness until Giselbert set the machinery in motion to close the vents. There was a whir, then a rattling of metal as chains unfurled and tumbled to the floor. The mechanism had been destroyed. When the noise settled, Bavrogor's singing could still be heard, softer and more muffled, but still audible. There was no talking among them, as they listened to his songs of dwarven heroism and glorious victories over the orcs. He was mocking the vast army, provoking his antagonists, luring them to their deaths. Then everything was quiet.
"There's no one here,"
Namora called down to the others.
"Just me and the mountains."
Tungdil looked up at her slim, black form, silhouetted against the pale sky. She disappeared from view. One by one they clambered to the surface. The flue terminated in a crater large enough to swallow a fair-sized house. Tungdil ascended the final paces with weary, leaden legs. At 3,000 steps he had stopped counting the soot-stained stairs that wound their way up the chimney's walls. There had been no moments of panic, no tripping, stumbling, or teetering on the edge, and the ascent had passed without incident, even for Jeroen in his cumbersome mail.
"We made it."
Tungdil emerged from the shelter of the rock to find himself on a snow-capped mountain at the heart of the Grey Range. An icy wind whipped about them, whistling through his beard and making him shiver with cold.
Looking down, he was filled with wonderment at the mighty valleys and gorges below. All around them were mountains, the towering summit of the Great Blade, the great pinnacle of the legendary Dragon's Tongue, and the sheer sides of Goldscarp. Clad in snow and buffeted by wind, the peaks rose majestically toward the clouds, enduring and eternal. Few had seen the range from such a privileged vantage point, and Tungdil was loath to tear himself away. He sent the half-alf ahead as their scout. The decision caused him considerable heartache. On the one hand, he wanted to protect Namora because of her role in the mission. On the other, he knew that she stood the best chance of leading the company to safety. Fergus was sick with worry on her behalf, but she struck out confidently through the snow, allowing the others to tread in her footsteps. Their path took them over shimmering bridges of ice, through sheer-sided chasms, and past deep gullies. From time to time, they clambered over snow-covered scree and through stone archways that seemed liable to collapse. They walked in silence, their tongues stayed by tiredness and all that had gone before. It was enough to focus on putting one foot in front of the other without tripping. Tungdil's thoughts drifted back to Giselbert and Bavragor. He could imagine them defending the gates against the enemy hordes, and if he closed his eyes for a second, he could almost hear the mason singing.
"The merry minstrel,"
he thought sadly. Later, as daylight faded and the wind picked up, they sheltered inside a cave, huddling around the torchlight. Boindil didn't seem to mind the cold, but Andukai brushed the snow from her cloak, pulled it close, and leaned back wearily against the bare rock. She lowered her blue eyes and cursed.
"I need to find a force field,"
she said, putting an end to the silence.
"The sooner we're back on charmed land, the better. My powers are exhausted. I never thought this would happen, and it's not an experience I'd choose to repeat. Quite apart from that, we're bound to need your magic before too long."
The shivering Tungdil produced his map of the underground network.
"I get the feeling that Nodon knows about the underground network. He'll guess we're heading for Ogre's death, and he'll probably be lying in wait."
He scanned the map attentively, his eyes coming to rest at a point 200 miles from their present location.
"He'll never think of looking there. We'll go to Alandur."
"To Alandur?"
blustered Boindil, who was carefully plucking ice from his beard.
"Whatever for?"
"There's a shaft leading down to the network," he told him, pointing to the map. "There's a good chance that this part of the kingdom won't have fallen to the Alfar. We'll ask the elves to join us and take up the fight against Nodon, just as the High King proposed. Unless you've got a better suggestion, of course."
No, the secondling conceded. "But I can't help. I mean, it takes a while to get used to the idea. Elves are our enemies, our sworn rivals."
"I can't imagine it either,"
admitted Belindis, nodding in agreement. She stretched her hands to the burning torch.
"How extraordinarily easy it is for one to dislike something," said Rodario philosophically.
He clutched his stomach just as it growled in protest. Like the others, he was ravenously hungry. Desperation drove him to break off an icicle and pop it in his mouth.
"The gods made us too dissimilar. Sitalia created the elves to love the skies and forests. Vrakas gave us our caverns and underground halls."
Belindis hugged her knees to her chest.
"They look down on us for not being beautiful like them. They despise us."
"Consequently, you despise them," the impresario divined. "Well, if one of you could see fit to stop despising the other, neither side would have reason to continue the feud. A whole history of hostility, resolved just like that."
He laughed, then gripped his injured side.
"Blasted orcs! Do you happen to have any other enmities that I can put to rights?"
"There's always Lorimbor's folk," Boindil said slowly. "You heard what Glandalin said about the Thirdlings, but it's no good trying to reconcile me with them."
He clenched his fists.
"To think that they betrayed the Fifthlings."
Rodario propped himself upright against the wall.
"What was the origin of the quarrel? We humans know shamefully little about dwarves."
He took up his quill.
"Keep it short, if you will. My ink is running low."
Belindis grinned.
"We hate each other."
His pen froze.
That was a little too short, worthy metalworker of Borengar.
He flashed her a winning smile.
I was afraid you'd say that.
Without further ado, she launched into the tale. The five founders of the Dwarven Folks were created by Vrakas, who gave each of them a name. The father of the Thirdlings cast off his Vrakas-given name and called himself Lorimbur, which is how he has always been known. The other dwarves each received a particular talent for their folks, and so the smiths, the masons, the gem-cutters, and the goldsmiths were born. But when it was Lorimbur's turn, Vrakas told him, "You chose your own name, so you must choose your own talent. Teach yourself a trade, for you can expect nothing from me." Lorimbur tried to teach himself a trade, and apprenticed himself to each of his brothers in turn, but his efforts went unrewarded. The iron cracked, the stone split, the gems shattered, and the gold burned. And so it was that Lorimbur came to envy his brothers, and his spiteful heart was filled with eternal hatred for all dwarves. Determined to excel at something, he applied himself secretly to the art of combat. His aim was not merely to defeat his enemies, but to kill every dwarf in Gerdlegard, so that none of his kin could overshadow him again. Rodario was hurriedly taking notes.
"This is wonderful," he murmured. "Enough to keep me going for 100 cycles or more."
Belindis cleared her throat. "Do you see why we're afraid of Lorimbur's folk? They're not to be trusted." Andukai changed position, trying to get comfortable on the rocky floor. "The Thirdlings aren't the ones we should be worrying about. How are we going to convince the elves of our intentions? Lord Liutasil is known for his reluctance to forge new friendships. I hardly think he'll rush to the aid of a company of dwarves." Tungdil watched the shadows cast by the torch and smiled. "I've learned from this journey that nearly everything is possible, even against the odds. I'm sure the elves will come round." At Belindis's request, Narmora handed over Keenfire, and the smith took to removing the excess inlay with a file. Tungdil looked on in fascination while she polished the metal. All of a sudden, she put down her tools.
"It's the cold," she said apologetically. "My fingers are really numb."
He glanced at Fergus and Narmora, who were snuggled under a blanket. His mouth went dry.
"You can sit a bit closer if you like," he offered nervously.
She sidled over and nestled against him.
"Like sitting by a furnace," she said with a sigh of contentment.
Tentatively, he laid an arm across her shoulders. There was something indescribably wonderful about having Belindis by his side.
Kingdom of Garagar, Gerdlegard, Winter, 6,234th Solar Cycle. They walked quickly, speeding up to a march as soon as the terrain permitted, and descending the southern slopes as fast as they could. Soon the mighty peaks of the Grey Range were behind them, and they found themselves among Gauragar's hills. They were all so exhausted that they didn't have much time to talk. After a while, Tungdil took Boindil aside and told him of Bavragor's last words. The secondling pressed his lips together tightly and said nothing, but his eyes welled with tears. Where possible, they avoided settlements, although on one occasion Fergus and Rodario were sent to buy provisions from a farm. Had the decision been left to the impresario, the pair would have posed as impoverished noblemen, but Tungdil, conscious of the need to keep a low profile, insisted that they pass themselves off as cobblers instead. The food tasted dreadful. The coming of the perished land had spoiled the winter crops and shriveled the apples, and even the bread was so heavy that it sat in their stomachs like lead. Still, it contained enough energy to restore a little of their strength. Since the groundwater was unpalatable, they melted snow to quench their thirst. At length, Jeroen hunted down a scrawny doe, which they roasted briefly over the flames and wolfed down hungrily, trying not to notice the slightly moldy taste. They hadn't been troubled by orcs since their escape from the Fifthling Kingdom, but after 7 orbits, the company's relief turned to puzzlement. The perished land had seized Garagar, but there was no sign of runts or Bognilim. By rights, the roads should be crawling with beasts. Unable to make sense of it,
Tungdil sent Fergus and Rodario to find out what was happening from the inhabitants of a nearby town. They returned with alarming news.
"The orcs were called away,"
said the impresario, waving his arms to convey the drama of his report.
"They've abandoned their encampments. A while ago, thousands of the beasts descended on the human kingdoms to rout the race of men, but now they're marching south on Nodon's orders. The townsfolk said something about besieging a stronghold in a mountain."
He frowned in concentration.
"I'll remember the name in a moment."
"Ogre's Death!"
Bowindil shrieked excitedly.
"It's got to be Ogre's Death! Ha! They need thousands of orcs to attack the dwarves of Berowin, do they? I always said the runts were worse than useless. Oh, what I'd give to fight beside my clansmen."
To the other's astonishment, Rodario shook his head.
"That's not it," he said. "Dark? No. Brown? No. I've always learned my lines perfectly, and now I can't remember a simple thing like this. It was something to do with leather."
His hands gesticulated frantically in the air.
"With leather and riding."
"Reins?" suggested Belindis.
Tungdil made the leap.
"The Black Saddle! They're besieging the Black Saddle!"
Andukai searched her memory.
"The name means nothing to me. What is it?"
"A flat-top mountain. The Thirdlings built a stronghold inside it and tried to wage war on the other folks. It's right in the middle of Girdlegard."
Tungdil pictured the Black Saddle's abandoned chambers and galleries.
"So why all the orcs?"
"Do you think someone important might be sheltering there?" asked Namora. "You know, someone Nodon is intent on getting his hands on, like one of the human kings."
Tungdil remembered telling Gundrabur and Belendilin about the stronghold, but he couldn't see why either of them would ensconce themselves in such a dark, benighted place.
"We should probably go there. The Black Saddle is practically en route."
They resumed their journey. 12 orbits after leaving the Fifthling Kingdom, they sighted Alandur. There was no need for Tungdil to consult his map. Nature was their guide. They were trudging through a snow-filled valley when they first spotted a lush forest of beeches, oaks, and maples in the distance, surrounded by a protective fence of pines. The vibrant colors and thriving trees were proof enough that, contrary to rumor, the last elven kingdom hadn't fallen to Nodon's hordes. This part of Girdlegard was free from the pestilence.
"I never thought I'd live to see the day when I'd welcome the sight of greenery," muttered Bowindil,
whose spirits were suffering from the long march through the perished land. His eyes swept the thick line of trees that formed a natural palisade against intruders. He reached for his axes.
"Looks like we'll have to chop our way through."